Jelani. In the East African language of Swahili, Jelani means strength. And in June 1996, when Carmen and Sevi Day welcomed their fourth child into the world, they named him Jelani. He was the fourth of five children and the youngest of his parents' three sons. The Days reared their children in a small town and in a loving church family. Like so many families who worship in the Pentecostal tradition of the Church of God in Christ or Kojic, the Days emphasized reverence and kindness. And like so many Black families in this country, the Days taught their children the value of excellence and achievement. Jelani Day grew up hearing a message familiar to many. You have to be twice as good. Handsome, young, beloved, connected, Jelani, the little boy, now man, named for strength, was destined for great things. And at 25 years old, Jelani had already begun to do them. He attended and graduated from Alabama A&M University, a historically Black college in Huntsville, Alabama. There, he pledged Omega Psi Phi Fraternity, the nation's first fraternal organization founded on the campus of a historically Black college. And this fall, he enrolled in graduate school at Illinois State University with the goal of pursuing a career in speech pathology. In August, Jelani Day went missing. Jelani's car was found a couple of days after he was reported missing, and it had no license plates or keys. 10 days later, Jelani's body was found in the Illinois River. He was 60 miles from his campus in a town where less than 1% of the population is African American and where he's had no known connections. Jelani was found in a river, but he was an avid swimmer who competed on his school's swim team. It took the local coroner's office more than 3 weeks to identify Jelani's body and notify his family. The family ordered a second independent autopsy and said in a statement on Facebook that there are contradicting facts between the preliminary autopsy and the second one. And because of this contradiction, the family is in the process of ordering a third autopsy. Here is Jelani's mother, Carmen Bolden Day, in an interview with CNN at the end of September. She's talking about how the local police have handled the investigation.
To them, Jelani didn't mean anything. There's no effort, there's no push, there's no nothing that was being done about my son. I did all that legwork. Me and my kids, me and everybody that never knew Jelani, my family, friends, strangers, did all the legwork. My son didn't get any type of help. And I'm pissed.
Police are continuing to investigate Jelani's death, but his family members and his fraternity at Alabama A&M University and local advocates, well, they all have concerns over Bloomington Police Department's handling of the case, and they're asking for federal investigators to intervene and take over. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and the story of Jelani Day is where we begin today's episode of The Takeaway. With me is Linda Foster, president of the Bloomington Normal NAACP chapter. Welcome to the show, President Foster.
Thank you so much.
And also here is James Wright, assistant professor at Florida State University, specializing in policing. Welcome to you as well, Professor Wright.
Thank you for having me.
Now, as we start our conversation, I want to acknowledge that so much of what I said here at the start about Jelani and about his life has been reported this month in a multi-article series penned by John Fountain of the Chicago Sun-Times. And Professor Wright, I want to start with you here because it was genuinely difficult to find real human information about Jelani and not just like the statistics about him. And I wonder about the ways that we don't talk about Black victims with the same kind of humanity and fullness that we often see with other victims.
Yeah, I think it's really important to acknowledge that. I think, you know, when we think about Black victims, we don't humanize them enough and we only see them as a statistic. And when you think about the issue with Jelani, you know, he was trying to be somebody in terms of he was trying to do something more with his life. He was trying to elevate himself. And yet we see that the continual narrative within society is that this is just another Black boy lost. And so I think it's important for us to recognize the humanistic element that comes with it when we think about Black boys and Black men that are missing or unidentified. And we really think about the human impact that it has, not just on himself, but on his family. And we heard it from the first audio that you played when his mother was crying for the police to help. And I think this is just emblematic of a bigger problem with the relationship between the police and communities of color.
Ms. Foster, let me come to you on that, because I find it difficult to hear the pain in the voice of Jelani's mother, Mrs. Day. Have you been working with the family? And I'm wondering what you know about how they're feeling and about how the broader community is feeling in Bloomington right now.
You know, as a mother, I can only imagine the pain and the anguish that this family is going through. It doesn't take much to know that he was loved, he was valued, and that he will be truly, truly missed. Our interactions, I've met Miss Day and the siblings, and yet, the ideas that the things that they are facing. I live right here in the Bloomington Normal area. And to know that all of us have a responsibility to help this family do whatever we can to let them know that we are here and that we care about what is happening and that we don't want anyone else have to face what they're facing today. And so you asked me about our interaction. We're here and we have made ourselves available and will continue to be that help as they will allow us to be.
Professor Wright, let me come to you on this. I you know, this is one of those stories that the facts were changing a bit. We're kind of watching it in national news. We're trying to figure out what's happening. And I was thinking that, you know, even over the weekend, there was the story of the African-American woman who was found in the back of a police van. And I got to say, like, my first impulse was, oh, my goodness, you know, had she been left there by the police? You know, surveillance video seems to say that's not what happened. But I'm wondering about how all of these kinds of stories really seem to reinforce a sense of the lack of humanity, right? Just that Black people, Black families, Black communities are hurting, are sad, are worried, are concerned for our loved ones.
I think you hit it spot on, right? The lack of humanity that exists when we think about the relationship that exists traditionally, historically, and concurrently now with the police and Black communities, I think part of this is the notion that, you know, we don't exist as humans and we are just seen as expendable within society from the standpoint from police officers sometimes. And I think this leads to a broader narrative that, like, what sort of relationship should exist between the police and the community? And it doesn't have to be antagonistic. But when we see examples of Jelani, we see examples of David Robinson, a boy that went missing in Arizona. We see examples of Keisha Jacobs. She had been missing in 2016, and the police said that she'd probably just ran away. I think the lack of attention to the humanistic element when it comes to the Black community is what triggers a lot of these emotions. And historically, if we don't have the best relationship to begin with, this is just deepening the tension and the frustration that exists between the police and the community.
Mrs. Foster, what can you tell us about the existing relationship between this police department and the community that you in part serve at the NAACP?
Thank you so much for asking that question. We have several police departments. As I stated earlier, Bloomington Normal. Bloomington has its own police department, Bloomington, the police department. And then we have Normal Police Department. Then we have Illinois State University police department, and then we have our sheriff department. So there's many agencies within this Central Illinois community. The relationship is a work in action. And what I mean by that, we are constantly rebuilding and building on our relationships by having a different vehicles in which we can come together for the greater good. We have an organization called MAP, Minority and Police Partnership, in which we meet quarterly, every other month, as needed, to have these conversations, have these hard conversations about relationship building of our community. The other piece is that we know these individuals. We know the chief of police of all of these agencies. And so we have a relationship that we can take time out to have the conversations about how do we better have a community that is one community. I said four agencies, but it's still one community. And so you constantly have to work at it so that we are being the community in which we all can be proud of. Now, you know, it's not perfect. No, it's not. But we have some solid ground here that we're working on. And so I appreciate the relationships that we have built in our community, and that we will continue to harvest the ideas of making our community one that one feels comfortable in, one feels safe in, and one feels as though that they can make a difference in.
Professor Wright, you know, I hear from President Foster there this, you know, desire to build relationship. Can you help us to understand, just sort of from a national or even historic perspective, if this kind of timeline in Jelani's case is typical when we're talking about a missing person and a recovered body, or was this long?
So I think with Jelani's case, it was a little bit longer than usual. Oftentimes, we'll see that there is more local detail that's put into finding a missing person case. And I think Jelani's case is emblematic of other cases of Black individuals that have gone missing. So I think it was a little bit longer than usual. I think it's a good idea for them to involve state and federal entities to help them think through the case of Jelani and other cases as well.
Now, because of the ways local authorities have handled the case, Day's family and friends have requested assistance from federal authorities. I want to just play you a clip for a moment of Jelani Day's mother in an interview with CNN.
Him and my youngest daughter, they both are going to be doctors. Dr. Jelani Day, Dr. Zaina Day. They have this competition with each other to make sure their GPAs stay up. My son wasn't involved in the streets. He wasn't a gangbanger. He wasn't nothing. But I guess if that could have been their narrative, then it would have been, oh, let's forget about him. But he was a productive citizen. I raised a good young man.
Still with me are Linda Foster, president of the Bloomington Normal NAACP, and James Wright, who is assistant professor at Florida State University. Dr. Wright, what does it mean that Jelani's mother felt she had to describe her son as a good young man?
You know, it's unfortunate that in society, when something happens to somebody that identifies as Black or Black American, that the first thing we always have to mention is that they weren't a gangbanger, they weren't doing drugs, they weren't selling drugs, because the assumption is in American society that if they're Black, they're up to no good. And I think it's something that happens too often when I think about myself, when I think about other individuals that are, you know, in the academic spaces or these other corporate spaces. We automatically have to tell people, listen, we're not a threat to your humanity, as well as you shouldn't be a threat to my humanity. So the fact that she had to mention that without the preconceived notion that he's not just reiterates how society views Black Americans. And it's just sad at this point.
President Foster, I know that your organization, the Bloomington Normal NAACP, along with other community members, have been holding events and rallies for Jelani Day. Do you think that community leaders are listening? Do you think that your police, who you've been working to build these relationships with, are listening?
I think that they are in a position whereas they are doing the best that they can. We are just a community that doesn't have these events that happen often. And yes, you know, we can do better. You know, law enforcement can do better at communicating with the families. They can do better with the man force, you know, putting enough of this attention to what's going on right now. They can do better at training. You know, how do you address these issues and not just wait till it happens? Our law enforcement, I believe, are in a position that they can only go up from here. And that it's unfortunate that we still deal with the issues of what matters, what life matters. Black lives do matter. And that it is important, it is imperative that all law enforcement is aware of this. And that we as a community have to be more impactful in making sure that they do know that. And that we do care. And that our loved ones are valued. There's a long history of why police are police. And it was because of us during slavery time. So we want to take that narrative and change it so that policing is supposed to be for all. But the first word in policing is serve. Serve its members of its community. So we would like to continue this conversation, come up with ways as a community to better help instruct on how the process should work, and that it should work for every individual, not just white women. And I have to say that because they get it right for them. They need to get it right for us as well.
That that point that you make about the fact that they can get it right. Professor Wright, let me come to you on this because I know that you too have been working to address community policing relationships in communities where you are in Florida. Can you talk to me about what some of those programs look like and whether or not they're moving these police forces towards getting it right?
Yeah, so we know that historically in Florida, and in particular, thinking about the South with these slave patrols, that there's a very negative perception of police officers because of the founding. So what we're doing in Florida actually is sort of reconciling and thinking through the history of the police departments. And in particular, thinking about in Florida, thinking about in Tallahassee, how can we change this narrative so that police forces can understand the sort of predatory nature that they have had and this antagonistic nature with Black people in Florida, and in particular Tallahassee. So we're working with our local sheriff and we're trying to get our local PD to implement these sort of history classes to understand what happened in Tallahassee, the history of policing, so that in the hopes that it can improve police relationships. Because if we don't reconcile with that history, if we don't start thinking about institutionalization of things, institutionalization of racism, systemic racism, we'll never have a police force that will truly be equitable for all. So that's one of the things we're doing with the sheriff's department here in Tallahassee.
James Wright is an assistant professor at Florida State University, working both in the academy and on the ground to do work around policing. And Linda Foster is the president of the Bloomington Normal NAACP and said so clearly what we needed to hear this morning. Black lives do matter. Thank you both for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate this opportunity to share with the community and then your listeners. We understand that there are racial disparities in everything that Black and brown people are involved in. But we're on this battlefield. The NAACP is on this battlefield to make it more equitable.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.